You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Rick Britton is a Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer. An award-winning historian, Rick also organizes history-related lecture classes in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On October 11, 2011, 5th President James Monroe presented the final lecture in a continuing series entitled Virginia History 201, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, A Dynasty of Friends. Monroe, of course, passed away in 1831, but historical interpreter extraordinaire Dennis Bigelow is the personification of our 5th President. A Vietnam veteran and well-trained thespian, Mr. Bigelow portrays James Monroe for Ashlawn Highland, the president's restored cabin castle. This is the final part of our 5-part series. Here's Dennis Bigelow as President James Monroe.
Hey, please be. Do be seated. You stand for the presidency, not necessarily the occupant. Well, all these strange things. Well, let me look at all of you. It may be the last time I'll have a chance to take you in. I'm leaving Charlottesville, you know. I've sold my property, Highland, and some of the best years of my life were here in Charlottesville. My goodness, I was Virginia's first United States Senator, living here in Charlottesville, and when I served under the Washington administration, which was not all happy, as I will tell you later on, my goodness, I was living here and serving as the first United States minister to the Republic of France. And, as some of you might remember, although you look all impossibly young to me, that in 1801, of course, when I was governor of Virginia, Charlottesville was incorporated as a full-fledged town. So, and I think I'm probably the only long-term resident, of Charlottesville, to actually have been introduced to the woman for whom this town is named. We speak, of course, of Queen Charlotte, of Mecklenburg, Sophia of Mecklenburg, you know. You know, people say such unkind things. You know, for years we used to say that Queen Charlotte never outgrew her ugliness. But I must tell you that I met the woman. Of course, I was introduced as our minister to London once I'd finished my business in Paris in 1803. And I found her quite comely, and obviously George III found her comely. She gave him more than 13 children, for goodness sakes. I think the only time she got any rest was when he went mad. You know, he went mad first in 1788, and then finally he got mad again. And now that miserable son of his is in. Well, never mind. Well, I am pleased to be here. I am, in fact, James Monroe, your erstwhile 5th President of the United States. John Quincy Adams is our sitting first magistrate. And this, of course, is October of 1828. Mr. Jefferson has been dead for longer than 2 years, and I miss my old friend of 47 years, but I'm rich in the friendship that I have with Mr. Madison, who lives but 30 miles to the north of us at his Montpelier. And now that Mr. Jefferson is dead, I speak more often of my oldest boyhood friend, lifelong friend, and comrade-at-arms in our fight for independence. I speak to you of John Marshall, our current Chief Justice of the United States. You know, Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Marshall detested each other, not simply because of their political differences, but because they were related to each other by way of the Randolphs. Now, and some of you know this, the Randolphs of Virginia are prone to madness, and a generation ahead of Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Marshall, there was a homicide in the family. a dispossession of property which went poorly for the marshals, and some other perfectly ghastly things that, I promised Mrs. Monroe I would not talk about in polite company. I wondered when I got up this morning what I was going to say to you. Sometimes Mrs. Monroe says to me, "Well, Colonel, start talking, and presently you'll think of something." Occasionally, my dear wife steps beyond her compass. But I must tell you, she is my companion. She's not only the mother of my children, but sometimes, and some of you know about this, you can have perfectly good conversations in pauses, in absolute silence, and then you know you have a boon wife, a boon companion. Now, there is nothing in youth, you are youthful and I am old, to prepare you for the vicissitudes of old age, save one thing, and that is a consciousness of duty faithfully performed. Now, when you reach the portal, I will have reached the portal long before all of you. You will not have your health. You'll be dead in the portal, you see. And you will no longer have your wealth. If you've accumulated any wealth, your heirs will have paid some attention to that long before your departure. And you will no longer have control of your reputations. Your reputations by then will be in the hands of others. But if you've had an understanding with Providence or God as to what you were put on this earth to do, and you have done it, then you will have, I am convinced, in the company of the deity, a consolation of duty faithfully performed. But, as you and I have discovered, the youth fail to understand this. You see, this is a sometime affair, this journey we were on, this business of duty. I give you a case in point. Several weeks ago, Mr. Madison and I finished our work as the senior members of the Board of Visitors of the University of Virginia. Now, the University of Virginia in late 1825 had a problem. It was not the looming death of Mr. Jefferson, the founder of the university. I think Mr. Jefferson was prepared for his end. I was privy once to a letter that he wrote to one of his own shortly before he died. "You must adore God, you must love your neighbor as yourself and your country more than yourself. You must be just, you must be true. You must not murmur at the ways of Providence, such that the world into which you have entered becomes the portal to one of eternal and ineffable bliss." Now there was a man who seemed to be prepared for his end. What he was not prepared for at that time was the conduct of the students at the University of Virginia. Now, in March of 1825, University of Virginia began with 114 students, and periodically, all of them, or so it seemed, would roar around the grounds and beat up all the faculty. And that was not considered a good sign for a new institution that had just opened its doors the previous March of 1825. And so with the death of Mr. Jefferson, Mr. Madison became the next rector of the university, and I, with my military background, was brought in to apply the rod of heaven to the misgivings of those students, and they came around soon enough. All but one, yes. His name was Edgar Allan Poe. Yes, he had to go. In any case, Mr. Madison and I finished our work as the senior members of the Board of Visitors of the University of Virginia, and we decided to go home by way of Monticello. I hope I've come to you in time. There's no reason for any of you to go to Monticello. Monticello was in a high state of decay. It took Mr. Jefferson 40 years to build that magnificent house, and it's falling apart as everything on this earth will eventually fall apart. And so there we were, Mr. Madison and I, outside of dead Monticello. And we were lost in our thoughts, you know. Mr. Madison had just put his affairs into the hands of his stepson, who's turned out to be a drunkard and a gambler. I'm sorry to tell you this, but it's demonstrably true. And I had left the White House in 1825, $75,000 in debt, and no sooner had I left the confines of Washington City than my creditors were hard upon you. Doesn't matter what you do for your community or anything else, the person who will not let you off the hook ever is your creditor. Maybe some of you have discovered that. I don't know. And so there we were, ruminating about our various problems. The last time we'd been up there was to receive the guest of the nation. You know, he came to Charlottesville twice. I couldn't be here the first time, but the second time we were up there at Monticello, and Mr. Jefferson was too ill. He couldn't leave his house. And so Mr. Madison and I were deputized to be outside to receive the guest of the nation, General Lafayette, at Monticello. And we waited and we waited. Mr. Madison was by my side, you see. We waited and we waited for him to get out of his carriage. It took him a very long time. Finally, he stepped down from his carriage. He looked so different. Have you discovered if you haven't seen somebody for a long time, they begin to look very different? We all knew him when he had a full head of hair. It's not necessary in life to have a full head. But his wig went to the, and he was bald. We didn't know that he was bald. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course. And then Mr. Madison. Now, when you go to see Mr. Madison, he loves to see patriots. So you should go and see. Not all at once, no. But you should go up and see him. He loves patriots. But Mr. Madison's a little deaf. He won't admit it, but he's a little deaf. So there he was, and we were waiting, and we were waiting. And finally, there was General Lafayette just getting out of his carriage. And Mr. Madison blurted out, "Oh, he looks rather over-refreshed." Why, you can't call a man fat. And you can't call a Frenchman fat. They don't. So it took a couple of glasses of Madeira to bring him around. So there we were, Mr. Madison and I, outside of dead Monticello, you see. And we began to think about our circumstances, and we did something that some of you will have to consider doing in the course of your lives, and that is we decided to take another oath to continue to serve our community and serve our nation until the end of our days. And when we did that, it's as if a weight came off of my shoulders and I reached down for Mr. Madison's hand. He's about 5'2" and getting shorter every week. And I grabbed him by the hand, and the two of us, like school children, skipped around Mr. Jefferson's West Garden, for we had resolved to function in adversity and finish our lives in some state of grace, whether we had a penny in our pockets or not. And some of you, my friends, in these difficult times, will have to do the same thing. Now, Mrs. Monroe has told me that for most of our marriage, I could keep a secret. But I've now reached an age where I appear to say almost anything that comes to my mind. And it's become a little distressing for her. And so I'm going to do it now, since she's not here to rebuke me, that dear wife of mine. There is nothing how do I say it? I don't think a man begins to understand himself until he has failed. Did you hear what I had to say? I don't think a man begins to understand himself until he has failed. Then and only then will he know what it takes to get up again and persevere. Now, I've held more senior executive positions than any other president to date. I've been president of the United States twice, the second time reelected without opposition. I've been Secretary of State and Secretary of War, and at one time during the War of 1812 under President Madison, I was simultaneously Secretary of State, Secretary of War, and Military Governor of Washington City. A little bit too much ambition there for that, you see. And I've been to Confederation Congressman three times, a U.S. Senator once. I've been your minister to Spain once, your minister to Great Britain once, your minister to France twice, the second time working closely with Robert Livingston and François Babin-Babois and Chambéry's Talleyrand and First Consul Napoleon for the purchase of Louisiana. Yeah. Which has doubled the size of our country. And when I became your president, when you elected me to the presidency, you see, in March of 1817, we had one secure frontier after the War of 1812, and that was the Atlantic Ocean. When I left office, 8 years later, we had secured much of our northern frontier, the border between Canada and the United States, east of the Rocky Mountains. We'd demilitarized the Great Lakes, always a source of tension between Canada and the United States. And we pushed the Russians out of Northern California back into Alaska from whence they come. Yes. And I strengthened the Navy. I strengthened the Army. I finished up West Point. Mr. Jefferson started it. I finished it up. I realized at last we needed a place to train a cadre of professional officers that the Army and militia had not performed universally well during the War of 1812. And I gave us a series of coastal fortifications along the eastern seaboard that have gone all the way into the interior so far as the confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers. I don't know. I don't know what it means, but it sounds something like homeland security to me, you see. I purchased Florida. You shouldn't hold that against me. And I gave us the Transcontinental Treaty of 1819 with the Spanish, which has given us a whole new border just north of Texas, up from the Sabine River, up to the Red River, up to the Arkansas River, up to the 42nd parallel, and then a swath that goes due west as far as the Pacific Ocean. And I think I've given us something of the bedrock of our foreign policy. It's not a law. It's an advisory, you see. It's not an executive order. The principles of 1823. You know, I suppose when I die, they'll call it the Monroe Doctrine. You wait and see when you die, they'll call, well, you, of course, you won't know when you die. But when you die, they'll attach things to your name as well. Which, in effect, has said the following, that North and South America should no longer be subject to colonization in the future, that the republics of North and South America are of a peculiar lot, and that if any foreign power attempts to meddle with the nature of those republics, that will invite an unhappy response from the United States. But I wonder if anybody will pay attention to the rest of it, the two other parts of it, that the United States should not get involved in the internal affairs of other countries, and implicitly that the United States should not get involved in any foreign wars, save as those wars are pressed upon us. But, gentlemen, do you remember that funny feeling behind your neck when you knew something was going to go wrong? You knew your life was going to change and it was not going to be for the better. I was Virginia's first United States Senator. It was Philadelphia. Philadelphia was our capital in 1793. I've been doing the expedient things for the Jeffersonians against the Hamiltonians. I must tell you, as much as I love this republic, it does seem that there are some unpleasant things we have to do in order to vanquish our political enemies. And I was at the heart of all of that. And it offended somebody. You know, yes, indeed, that's right. It offended President George Washington. And he decided to get rid of me. So he seduced me into becoming America's first ambassador to the Republic of France. And I arrived in Paris 5 days after Maximilien Robespierre, the great dictator, had been decapitated. All hell had broken loose in Paris again, and I spoke a kind of French best understood by Virginians. And my dear wife, you need a companion for some journeys. My dear wife, to save the day for the future fifth president of the United States. She spoke very nice French, and she was so beautiful in the eyes of the Parisians. She's so beautiful even today. And although 2 years ago she took a fall into a fire and burned a third of her body, and now she's taking 250 drops a day of laudanum. Laudanum, as you know, is a combination of opium and alcohol for the maintenance of pain. She is still my beautiful Mrs. Monroe, my great companion. But she purchased me enough time to get into a heap of trouble all by myself. I put a bear hug on the French. I didn't know what John Jay was doing in London. They don't tell you everything in government, you know that. I suspect you do know that. And that's precisely what President Washington wanted me not to do. And so he recalled me, which is a very nice diplomatic expression for you're fired. And so I came home thoroughly fired in 1797, which was excellent preparation for my next presidential firing, this time 10 years later, at the hands of my closest neighbor and best friend, President Thomas Jefferson, who in 1803 had sent me back to Paris to buy a little land. Well, that worked out all right. It was called the Louisiana Purchase. I do believe it's the largest transfer of real estate in modern history without resort to war. And I asked the president, oh, it all takes so much time. I suppose they'll do something. I took a steamboat ride. I love steamboats. It was one of the things that pleased me throughout the Great Lakes. You have to keep your eyes closed sometimes because of the cinders in your eyes, and you have to watch the bulkheads. But if you can learn to do that, you see... And there's great speed there. You wait and see. It'll cut down time a lot. But, well, in any case, it was bad news. I didn't need to know bad news that fast. But I got it in time. Mr. Jefferson said to me, no, sir, Colonel, you cannot come home yet. You're still on duty. I want you to go to London to see if you can get the British to stop impressing or taking our sailors. And I arrived in London, and the British said to me, now you know, Ambassador, we've been impressing sailors for 200 years. We're not going to stop now. And by the way, sir, we are in a life and death struggle with Napoleon. Whatever you ask, the answer is no. And so I worked on this little commercial treaty. Now, I want you to understand something. I talked about this treaty later on, when things were not going so well for Mr. Madison and his administration in 1811, and I said, sir, before you bring me on as Secretary of State, I want to tell you that this little treaty of conciliation was not a bad treaty. If it had taken us back to our relationships with the British in the 1790s, what's so bad about that? But in any case, the treaty got back to Mr. Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson, I'm afraid, was in a particularly Anglophobic state of mind. And he had other constituencies to take care of, and the whole thing seemed to die right there. But they punished me. You know, when things are not going well, there's always somebody in government to punish you. The wags of the Jefferson administration made sure that I'd be punished, and they sent Billy Pinckney of Maryland over there to London to give me a kick in the derriere. And so the two of us worked on this treaty. We worked this treaty, and then we got it back to President Jefferson. Jefferson said, this is the most dreadful treaty I've ever seen. I'm not even going to submit it to the Senate. And then, my friends, I got a terrible letter. You know, sometimes you can work as hard as you can for an immediate superior, and you're still going to get a terrible letter. And it came from Secretary of State Madison speaking for President Jefferson, saying, it appears, Minister Monroe, that your mission to London has been a failure. Maybe you ought to come home. Maybe you're recalled. Maybe you're fired. And so I came home thoroughly fired for the second time in 10 years in 1807. Now, you think about this for a moment. Is this not an extraordinary country when a man could be fired by the first president of the United States, his former commander-in-chief, who given him a commendation for putting out of commission two Hessian three-pounders at a critical point of the Battle of Trenton, which was a do-or-die battle to his nibs, General Washington and the nation, and then 10 years later to be fired by one's closest neighbor and best friend, Mr. Jefferson, only to come home and get suckered into running for the presidency against Mr. Madison and lose, and then to be thrown into the political wilderness from which I was not supposed to return. But I did, to become the fifth president of the United States. Is there a message here? Not for any of you, because you know the message. But in these hard times, there's some people out there who do not know the message. And the message is, when you get knocked down in life, you must get up again. When you get knocked down in life, you must get up again. Now, Mrs. Monroe always says, now, Colonel, once you start talking, the great danger is that you'll put everyone into the arms of Morpheus if you talk too long.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.